Okay. Today we're covering the two chapters. If you got to read them, that's good. And if not, we'll go over as much as we can. The first chapter is when God says no. And I want to talk a little about about that one. There's a line in an old hymn, and it says, "What he takes away or what he gives us shows the Father's love so precious." Now, it's easy for us to sing, "What he gives shows the Father's love to us." That's easy for us to sing, okay? But it's hard for us to sing the other side. "What he takes from us shows the Father's love for us." That's harder for us to take sometimes. We think of love as something that's giving. When people give, you know, that's loving. But sometimes love involves taking away. Taking something that maybe it's not even bad, but it's not the best. And so it has to be taken away. Think of your broken dreams. You may have broken dreams. Think of the times that you felt that something was the plan of God for your life. You were convinced it was God's plan for your life. To only have it stopped and have the Father reveal to you in some way, "That's not my plan." If that's ever happened to you, it's happened to me, I have to confess to you that at times when that's happened, I haven't always been on the best of terms then in my emotions with the Lord when he said that to me, because it's like, wait a minute, I thought this was your plan for me, and I'm just excited about it, and now you're telling me, whoa, you're off track. That's hard to take sometimes. And maybe the plan or the dream that we had, maybe it had a noble purpose. In fact, that's a great resolve sometimes for you, but then God says, "But that's not my plan for you." That is hard to hear. And King David learned just how hard it was in this chapter this week. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, it begins with David being settled in his palace finally. You know, he's been out there warring all over the land for so many years and so long. Now he's at a place where he's settled in his palace. The Lord had given him rest from all his enemies. Ooh, wouldn't that be good if you could feel that way? I've got rest from all my enemies, whatever they might be.
I'm there now. Because where I was staying for a while is I was in a cave. Nobody knew where I was. I was hidden away. My armor bearer won't let me give her name out. But her home was the first Our Savior's Lutheran Church. My bed was at the altar. And I was in a cave, and I'm now out of that cave, and now I'm in my home, and it's becoming my palace.
See? And so, and that for, I mean, we all have, like, different circumstances that we can look at sometimes in our life, and it's like that. And that's what David is. For once, he's at a place where he's been given rest from his enemies. And so as he's sitting there kind of enjoying life a little bit, he begins to reflect upon this lovely cedar-lined palace that he lives in, and he begins to dream. And he begins to talk about his dream. He talks about his dream to Nathan the prophet. And Nathan was, you know, David's counselor at this point in his walk. He was his wife's counselor. He was the prophet. And then in verse 2, David says to Nathan, he says, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells within tent curtains." You know, it's like, what's with that? He's feeling bad about that. And so Nathan says to the king, "Go and do all that is in your mind, for the Lord is with you." So David just got wise counsel. Maybe sometimes you have a real trusted friend or a prayer partner or someone who's your spiritual advisor, and you might reveal to them a dream on your heart, or, "I believe this is what God's saying or showing me." And they say, they encourage you, "Go for it." So you figure, well, they must be right, because I know they're a really, you know, a person who really walks with the Lord, and they seek the Lord, and they hear from God, so it must be a green light, okay? Well, that's what a good friend does. Good friends encourage you. Nathan encouraged David to follow through on what was in his heart. But God had other ideas about it. See, Nathan, we're not told that he went away and he took time with the Lord to check it out with him. He was just being a good friend and saying, "Yes, go for it, whatever's in your heart." Okay, whoever has the scripture in chapter 7, verses 4 through 8, would you read that now?
That night the word of the Lord came to Nathan, saying, "Go and tell my servant David, this is what the Lord says. Are you the one to build me a house to dwell in? I have not dwelt in a house from the day I brought the Israelites up out of Egypt to this day. I have been moving from place to place with a tent as my dwelling. Wherever I have moved with all the Israelites, did I ever say to any of their rulers whom I commanded to shepherd my people of Israel, 'Why have you not built me a house of cedar?' Now then, tell my servant David, this is what the Lord Almighty says, that I took you from the pasture and from the following the flock to be ruler over all my people, Israel."
So, you know, David's being told, "Hey, I have appointed you to be a king, not to build a temple." But why? Why would God tell him no? In 1 Chronicles chapter 28, in verse 3, God had told David he could not build the temple because he was a warrior and he had blood shed on his hands. Okay? So God gave him a reason. Sometimes God doesn't even give us a reason when he says no. And that's even harder sometimes to take. But God gave him a reason. And David understood that reason. It isn't a question of sin here that God's saying he can't build a temple. It isn't God's judgment that is coming upon David as a consequence of something wrong that he did. It is simply God redirecting David's plan. See, God's not looking at David and saying, "You know, you were this violent person, there's a lot of blood on your hands, and you know, you all that, you know, sin and that." No, because God's purpose for David was to take all the territory, was to do all those things. God anointed him in battle. Yes, there was bloodshed, and sometimes that's necessary for the purposes of God all through Scripture to be carried out. So David was being obedient to God, but because he was a warrior, right there, Betty, on the table. God was saying, "That was what I had for you. And you've been anointed king. You're not going to build the temple, though." He's redirecting. He does that a lot in our lives, sometimes when we don't ask for it. So,
right.
Let's see if I can do this without my glasses. Continuing in chapter 7, at the end of verse 11, it says here, Nathan is speaking here, I believe, for the Lord. "The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you." He's saying this to David. "When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." So God's giving David a reason, and he's telling him something for David to set, you know, set in stone. He's got an answer. This is the plan. You're not the temple builder. It will be your son. So then in the rest of the chapter, in verses 18 through the end of the chapter, is all a record of David's prayer. And so if you didn't get to read it, I would ask you some time to go back and read it, because it's a very good pattern for us. It's a very lengthy prayer, but David is expressing in this prayer his humble acceptance now of this promise God has just made to him to extend his dynasty forever. That's basically what God has said to him. Your dynasty will never, never end. There will be a king on the throne of your bloodline forever. Well, David realized that these blessings that were being given to him in this promise and being given to his descendants, they were not just for himself, but they were in order for Israel to benefit from them in the future. David realized this. It was more than just him and his family. That these blessings God's promising would help fulfill God's greater purposes and his promises through the nation of Israel as a whole, that the whole world would be blessed. And that was what God had spoken all the way back in Genesis chapter 12 to Abraham. All nations will be blessed through you. So God's still continuing that promise. He said, I haven't forgot about it, even though it was centuries ago, you know, more than 1,000 years ago. Now I'm telling you this. So David's earthly natural dynasty lasted 400 years. So for 400 years, there was always someone on the throne from the line of David, which God had promised. Well, why only 400 years? Because they didn't need it after that, because Jesus came. So after 400 years now, Jesus, who was a direct descendant from the line of David, okay, was the fulfillment now of this promise. That's why God said it will never end, because Jesus came, Jesus sits on the throne, now he's our king, and that will not end. So that promise was fulfilled. 400 years was the natural reign of David's dynasty. So David made the plans for the temple, and he collected all the materials so that his son Solomon could begin work as soon as he became king at the appointed time. So what does this say to us? David was willing to accept God's no. He didn't argue about it. He didn't complain. You know, think about it for yourself. Have you ever prayed with good intentions only to have God say no? Absolutely no. And that sometimes is God's way of redirecting your life, my life. You know, sometimes we're on a, you know, we think, whoa, we're really in a good direction here. But God says, we got to take a little, my plan was this way. You're at the fork in the road and you took the wrong angle here. Come on, we're going to redirect and get you back on the right path. When God redirects us, it's because he has a greater purpose for us than where we are now, even though we're in a good place. He wants the best for us. We like to package everything just right, how it's going to work for us, what our dream will be. And then we expect God to package his plan just like we would package it. The same way, okay? We want the logic that we use to be God's logic for us, too. And sometimes there's a collision there, isn't there? Because it's not always the same. So accepting God's no requires as great a faith in us as carrying out his yes does. When he tells you yes to do something, it takes great faith to carry it out. It takes even a greater faith to when he says no. Okay, would the reader for 1 Chronicles 22, verse 2 through 5, read that one.
So David gave orders to assemble the foreigners residing in Israel, and from among them he appointed stone cutters to prepare dressed stone for building the house of God. He provided a large amount of iron to make nails for the doors of the gateways and for the fittings, and more bronze than could be weighed. He also provided more cedar logs than could be counted for the
Sidonians. Interior.
And sorry,
that's okay.
My reading level isn't as high.
The people from Sidon and the people from Tyre
had brought large numbers of them to David. David said, "My son Solomon is young and inexperienced, and the house to be built for the Lord should be of great magnificence and fame and splendor in the sight of all the nations. Therefore, I will make preparations for it." So David made extensive preparations before his death.
So he's going and he's putting all the stuff together that he knows Solomon's going to need. And he's going to far-reaching places. You know, he's not just there in his own little hometown doing it. He's going, you know, Tyre and Sidon are both in Lebanon. Is that correct, Ed? Yeah, they're both in Lebanon. Lebanon's just below Syria. No. I'm sorry. Yes. Yes. It's just below it, too.
Western Syria. North of Israel.
Because when we went there, we went between the two. So that's why I have to get in my mind, wait, now which cities are in what? It's in Lebanon. They're both in Lebanon. And so, remember, Lebanon was famous for its cedar trees, the cedars of Lebanon. And you all know what a cedar closet smells like and a cedar chest. It's really a wonderful aroma. And so that's where all the wood came from to build the temple. So just think what that must have, that must have had a really neat smell. Like, you know, when you buy a new house and you go into a new house and it's got that new house wood smell in it. It's just so neat. Doesn't last forever, but...
I don't know what new car smells like.
Yeah, so the new car.
The rest is particle board and dude.
Yes, so the new smell is good while it lasts. But David spared nothing in getting the best of everything. Did you have a comment, Carol?
I have a question. So this promise that God gave and all of this, this all transpired before Bathsheba and the whole thing. So he didn't even know who was going to be reigning after him, you know, saying as far as what son God was going to choose for.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's before Bathsheba, okay, which is correct. So, but God knew it was going to be Solomon.
Yeah. So I'm just saying David didn't have a clue. It's like,
correct.
You know, so.
He's referring to like his son, whatever. Right. Worse in the Bible, it tells us soon. Solomon.
Okay.
In fact, next class is all about Bathsheba.
Okay.
So we get into that next time. So, what are the things, one of the points I want to bring out here from this is how we can apply it today, okay? If you want helpful hope for a broken dream that you have, I see two simple truths in all of this so far. The first is, when God says no, it means he has a better way and he expects you to support it. It doesn't mean he's always going to tell us what the better way is. It's just like sometimes as a parent, when your kids are little, sometimes do you not just say no to them? Well, if they're 2 years old, you're not going to explain to them why they can't just run out into the street, or they're 1 year old, because they're not going to understand your explanation. You just have to tell them no, and they have to learn to behave that, you know? And that's how it is sometimes with us. Sometimes we're at a point in our life, or even in our spiritual walk, if we walk with the Lord a long time, sometimes we're at a point where God knows that if he gave us the details or the explanation of why he said no right now, we're not at a mature level, not whatever, to understand it fully, and it wouldn't come out right for us. So sometimes he'll just say no, and we have to wait for him to reveal why he said no. He never does the same thing all the time, except for the fact that whatever he does, it's always to draw out the best of what he has. So, the second thing is that when that happens to you, your very best reaction to God saying no is cooperation and humility. If we cooperate with God, even though we don't like it, like, you're sending me over here, I hate it over there. But if we cooperate and we don't murmur and grumble in the process, which I'm famous for, and we are humble before God, you know, well, I know you're sending me over here, Lord, and I have to be honest, I'm really not looking forward to going over there, but because you have the best for me and your plan, I'm going to do what you say, and I'm not going to murmur and grumble. Cooperation and humility. God doesn't call everybody to build the temple, but he does call everyone to be faithful and obedient. If we stay faithful and obedient, we'll stay on the right track with him. To some, he says yes, and to others, he says no. In either case, whether he says yes or no, the answer is best. Why is it best? Because God's answers, while not even sometimes, many times, are surprising. They are never wrong. They're never, never wrong. They may surprise us and shock us, but they're never wrong. So sometimes some of you may be living with broken dreams. I mean, sometime in the past, maybe you had high hopes for your life that it would go in a certain direction. And maybe God planted that dream in you at one point. But maybe it's not the time for the fulfillment of it, but we're trying to push it because we know that's what our destiny is. But the Lord maybe for some mysterious reason unknown to us, has said no. And so you moved along in life, and now you're up maybe in years, like maybe I am, and you find yourself becoming slowly shelved by the younger ones who are taking charge and moving on. That's God's plan. How quickly age takes over. I found a statement, a quote by James Dobson. Most of you are familiar with James Dobson, and he put it beautifully. And those of you who are closer to my age will really relate to this. The younger people won't. He says, about the time our face clears up, our mind gets fuzzy. And then he says, just about the time we get our act together, okay, we're too old to pull it off. And so what do? We turn it over to the Solomons in our lives, those who are coming up behind us, the younger generation, okay? We turn it over to the Solomons, and it takes real humility to say to that person, may God be with you. I will do everything I can to support you in seeing that it gets accomplished. And that's hard sometimes, because sometimes God's given you a dream to do something, and you were like the first step in the plan, and that was your baby, and you birthed that baby, and it's grown so far, but now it's for the next generation or the next person to take over. And that's hard to handle. It's like, you know, what about me? Am I chopped liver out? And sometimes we may get jealous, we may get angry, or, you know, or we just step aside, but we're not stepping aside with blessing that one that's going to fill that position maybe we had. And God calls us to do that. It's not always easy to do, though. Questions or comments so far on this chapter? Dennis.
If David would not have been a warrior or a man with blood on his hands and would not have killed the giant Goliath, where would all these folks be now?
Well, that's a good question, because remember, who came from that line? Jesus. So just think about it. Sometimes when we want to be disobedient in something, what link in the chain of God's plan are we maybe breaking? Because we didn't want to go with the flow. Yes, Lynn?
But in God's sovereignty, mm-hmm. He knew David's heart.
Yes.
He chose people he knew would follow his plan. I think he mm-hmm. still does that today. He, you know, he doesn't change. So he's calling someone to do something he knows their heart, and then follow through with it.
That is true. And he still allows us to say no.
Right.
We can say no. And he'll let you get away with that for so long. And then finally he'll say, he'll move on to that other person that he knows will say yes. And we were the loser, because down the road we missed out on something really magnificent. Yes.
The 9 years that I was with Bob, I wasn't able to do the jail ministry the way that I want to.
Mm-hmm.
Since I finally did the PPO and I did the divorce, I'm not divorced yet, but I will be. The girls are coming out of the woodwork. I've got 30 of them on my Facebook now that are coming back, and the Lord is saying, now it's time for the jail ministry to be resurrected. But like you said, in my time, not in Deb's time,
right,
in God's time. But he is bringing key ones, because I'm going to have a bake sale for to raise money, because mm-hmm. I can't afford, I mean, I've got $1,000 in expenses right now.
Mm-hmm.
He has raised up 4 already that are going to run the bake sale for me, because I'm having chemo all next week. And they're going to run it for me. Now, these are girls that I had in the jail 12 years ago that remember me. And they see me out in public. And one of them saw me at the doctor's office. One of them saw me in Walmart. One of them found me on Facebook.
See, when it's God's time and God's plan,
he brings them.
He will bring them.
And he is.
But sometimes, I know, like for me, because I'm going through this sometimes a little with my prayer group and that,
right.
And it's like, if you try to force it, if I try to force it, and it's just, you know, when it's really God's time, he will bring them. Did you have a comment, Ed?
Yeah, go back to what Dennis said. I think if David hadn't done it, somebody else would have. Right. God's plan is going to, it's sovereign. It's going to
happen.
It's going to rain. Who knows how many were anticipated that said no before David.
That's
we never know that. We just know what Scripture tells us. So his plan is perfect, and it'll be carried out no matter what.
It's true. Right. It's true.
Just real quick, where's the big sale at?
I got to stay on the time thing so that I don't keep
Pastor
back
Dave,
the time for
well,
service.
Let me know after.
Okay.
No, Pastor Dave will mention it.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, now I'm going to move on to chapter 9. Okay. So chapter 9 is grace in a barren place. That's a word we hear a lot, we all know about in the church. You know, the word grace, it means many things to many people. We refer to a ballet dancer as having grace. Okay, we say grace at meals. We talk about the people like the Queen of England bringing grace to events that she attends. She brought grace, added grace to that event. Grace can mean coordination of movement. It can mean a prayer. It can refer to dignity and elegance. But most importantly, to those of us who know the Lord, grace can mean that unmerited favor. Extending special favor to someone, you know, who really doesn't deserve it. They haven't earned it, and they can never repay it. So we find one of those moments now in the life of David. And it involves an obscure man and all with an almost unpronounceable name. And we enter now into the story, Mephibosheth. In chapter 7, we just saw an interlude of peace and quietness in David's life, during which time, you know, he spent thinking about all the past blessings that had been his. He's, you know, thinking back on these things. And as he did so, I have to think that he thought specifically about that great love he had for Jonathan, who had been his best friend. Jonathan, who had been killed in battle. Not only Jonathan, but about Jonathan's father, Saul, who had been David's predecessor, the king before him. I'm sure a lot of this was going through his mind, too. And while reflecting upon these two men and what the impact was that they'd had on David's life, you know, he probably began to think about the promise that he made. And he pondered it, and then he addressed it. And in 2 Samuel chapter 9, we find that. In verse 1, David says, "Is there yet anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" See, he's wondering about this now. Well, why did he want to do that? Because he had made two promises. Remember back when David was still running for his life from Saul? Okay? He was obviously destined for the throne at that point. And whoever has 1 Samuel chapter 20, verses 13 through 17, let's read what Jonathan said back at that time. Who has it?
I got it.
"But if my father intends to harm you, may the Lord deal with Jonathan, be it ever so severely, if I do not let you know and send your way in peace. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. But show me unfailing kindness like the Lord's kindness as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord call David's enemies to account." And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved David himself. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon feast. You will be missed because your seat will be empty."
That's okay. That's okay. So remember, we had talked about this earlier, that it was the custom way back then in the Eastern dynasties that when a new king took over, all the family members of that previous dynasty were all killed. And they did that so that there would no rebellion would come to overthrow the new king. So they killed off everybody in that family. That was common. That was how it worked. Everybody knew that then. So that's why Jonathan is saying this to David. This was back when Saul was going to find David and kill him and all this and that. And so Jonathan's saying, you know, Jonathan's really just kind of bottom lining it, saying, David, when you get to the throne, because I know you will, okay, as surely as you will you show my family grace? That was going against the grain of the time. Okay, so later you may recall, once again, after David had, and in 1 Samuel chapter 24, after David had spared Saul's life in the cave, when he could have taken it, and he didn't, Saul says this to him in verses 20 through 22. Saul says to David, I know that you will surely be king and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands. Now swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family. So David gave his oath to Saul. So David made the promise both to Jonathan and to Saul. So now we find David reminiscing back and remembering these promises he made. So in chapter 9, in verses 2 and 3, in answer to David's question, is there not anybody left from Saul's line? They find out, yes, they identified someone. And they found a servant from Saul's house who had been a servant there, and his name was Ziba. And they called Ziba in to David, and the king asked him, is there not yet anyone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God? And Ziba told him, he says, yes, there's still a son of Jonathan. So Jonathan has some surviving son here, okay, who is crippled in both feet. That thing's a little odd. I mean, if I was telling someone about one of you, they said, do you know such and so? Oh yeah, I know this person, they have crippled feet. But that's the very first thing out of my mouth. Why would I say that? Why would that be the first identifying thing I would have to say about that person? And they said, his name is Mephibosheth. Okay, they were taking a little license here, but if you read between the lines, possibly Ziba, when he said this, is implying to David, David, you really better think twice before you do this, because this guy's not going to look real good in your court. Because remember, they were part of the king's court then, and they were brought into the king's home and kind of adopted in. So it's like, come on, you really want this cripple as part of your court? Now, they always kept the beautiful and the best and all this and that. So he may have been thinking that in how he gave his answer, but it's David's response that's really beautiful. David just moves right on. He doesn't even address that. He just moves right on, and he says, where is he? He doesn't ask how badly is he crippled. You know, he doesn't even ask how it happened that this person is in this condition. Nothing. He just says, where is he? Okay? So we find the answer to how Mephibosheth got into that condition. Way back in 2 Samuel in chapter 4, verse 4, it tells us that when he was a young boy of 5 years old, that's when word first came that Saul had just been killed, Jonathan had just been killed, and so the little boy's nurse wants to protect him, because remember what's going to happen. They're going to kill off all the family now, right? The king is dead, the new king's going to get rid of them all. So the nurse takes him, she runs, she wants to escape with him, and in the process, she's in a hurry, she drops him, and it injured him and caused him to become crippled. So then he was taken away into hiding. No one knew anything. No one knew he was alive, except his servant Ziba knew. And so now he's telling this to David. And David just said, where's the man located? That's the way grace is. Grace isn't picky. Grace doesn't look for things that have been done that deserve love. Grace operates apart from the response or apart from the ability of the individual. It has nothing to do with it. Grace is one-sided. It's God giving himself in full acceptance to someone who does not deserve it, someone that can never earn it from him, and someone who will never be able to repay it. just like Mephibosheth. So in verse 4, Ziba says to the king, he says, behold, he's in the house of Makar, the son of Amiel, in Lo-debar. That last geographical term is a little interesting because Lo-debar, in the Hebrew language, Lo means no, debar means without pasture or no fruitfulness. So it's a barren kind of thing, okay? It's a barren place. And it also means no significance. So this descendant of Jonathan is in a place where it's desolate. He lives out in some obscure, barren field somewhere in the wilderness. It's the complete opposite of his rightful inheritance. Remember, this is the grandson now of King Saul. So, you know, this is his inheritance. Can you imagine the man's shock? Okay, we don't know how old Mephibosheth is at this point in time, but we know that he had a family because in verse 12 it tells us that he had a young son named Micah. So he's got this young son, so he's got to be a lot older at this point. He's not a little kid anymore. So whoever has that, chapter 9, verse 6 through 8, will you please read it now?
When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, Mephibosheth, at your service, he replied. Don't be afraid, David said to him, for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table. Mephibosheth bowed down and said, what is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?
Okay, let me add here. A dead dog like me. Well, wait a moment now. I mean, think about it. What a moment this must have been. Can you imagine what Mephibosheth must have felt like just in that moment, okay? He's expecting a sword to strike his neck. You know, they dragged me off to the king now. They took me to the king because he must have found out now about me, and that's it. It's curtains for me. I'm going to get beheaded because that was the way they did it. He's expecting to be killed. And then he hears these unbelievable words from King David. I mean, we also see here how Mephibosheth views himself. He calls himself a dead dog. In some translations, it says a stray dog. A dead dog. That's pretty bad if you think of yourself like that. A stray dog. That's kind of like someone who doesn't belong anywhere. You have no home. You don't belong anywhere. You're just a stray dog. Nobody cares about you anyway. So this is what he's thinking about himself. So then in verses 9 and 10, it says, then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table. And then it tells us that now Ziba, the servant, had 15 sons and 20 servants. So he's got a whole crew here already to take care of the property that's being given. Okay? So, let me continue on and then I'll see if we have time for more questions. For us. Okay, Mephibosheth has just heard this wonderful thing from the king, that the king is giving all this to him to provide for him. He's giving him his inheritance that was part of his destiny. Our king today is still seeking people who are spiritually disabled in the spirit. And sometimes we are in a wilderness of shame, as Mephibosheth was. He was shamed because of his crippledness. But do you know who you really are? Or are you living with a false name that the enemy gave you? Or the enemy has convinced you of? Maybe it's a name that convinces you of being unworthy. And yet the king, our king today, the king has set his heart on you. He wants to be the exterminator of your shame. That was one thing I forgot to mention, that Mephibosheth called himself a dead dog. But in Hebrew, his name really meant exterminator of shame. And so our king wants to be the exterminator of our shame. And he's calling you by your God-given name, not the name that the enemy has given you for any reason. He's calling you by the God-given name, and he's calling you to take your place at his table, just as David did with Mephibosheth. Take your place at his table. I mean, isn't that great? No, it's not great. It's better than that.
Fantastic.
It's grace. It's grace. It's grace. Okay? So the analogy here is clear, that God has taken us from where we were, and he brought us to where he is. It's like David did with Mephibosheth. He brought him to a place of fellowship with him. He's restored to us what once we had once in Adam, way back at the beginning, and was lost. So, David adopted Mephibosheth into his family, and he became like one of the king's sons. So we kind of end this chapter, I hope, with a smile. A smile because it's a thank you, Father, for finding us when we weren't even looking, and for loving us when we weren't even worthy, and for making us yours when we didn't even deserve it. For setting a place at your banqueting table for us. And today with communion, it's another reminder to us that we come to God's banqueting table, and he invites us there to come and have fellowship and sup with him. I mean, grace, it really is amazing. Any questions, comments? None? Oh, my goodness.
You're just a good teacher.
Anybody?
Cover it.
Knowing that, or you're all sleeping. Come on, somebody's got to have something to say. None?
He, Mephibosheth, was the only survivor of Saul's dynasty?
No, my notes said that he wasn't.
He wasn't? Okay. Mm-hmm. So, but he was the only one that was blessed by David.
I think he was really Jonathan's.
Yeah, and he was Jonathan's son, and perhaps he was the oldest son, which is the one who gets the inheritance all the time. That's all we know.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, next week we're going to do chapters 11 and 12. Bathsheba.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Ann.
You're welcome.
Pastor Dave will mention it, but it is going to be Friday and